Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Dressed in a blue suit and red tie, the disheveled man looks out of place in a Vietnamese jungle. Beneath each arm, he's precariously carrying a child as he runs through knee-high water. He looks panicked. He has reason to. Overhead hovers a helicopter. Someone inside of it is beaming down a spotlight, its light following the man as gunfire pierces the water alongside him as he darts away from the helicopter and toward the shore. Suddenly, there's an explosion, a bright flash of fire and light that illuminates the dark sky. It's about 2:30 in the morning. The pilot in the chopper feels the heat emanating from below. One of the thatch-topped huts lining the riverbank has been blown to bits. The man continues to trudge through the river below, the children dangling from his grasp as he tries to keep his footing. Another explosion, then another and another. The fireballs are blinding. The man, now halfway across the river, slips and stumbles with the two children. One of them, a 6-year-old girl, is dropped into the water as her savior rearranges his grip and works to recover quickly from his fall. Just as he does, with the explosion still surrounding him, the helicopter falls into frame, its main rotor wiping from existence the man and two children as it crashes into the shallow water. That's what we see in the footage of the final minute of the lives of actor Vic Morrow, age 53, and his two young scene partners, Renee Chen and Mika Lee, ages 6 and 7 respectively. The moment of their demise was filmed for a segment of the 1983 film Twilight Zone the Movie, and thanks to a resulting court battle, is public for all to find. What you can't find on YouTube are the moments that came immediately after the tragic deaths, the beat of silence after the helicopter falls still, the pilot and others inside stumbling out of the cockpit and rushing to safety, the A-list producer lifting little Renee's body out of the water and setting her on the shore. You can't see the firefighter who had been intentionally kept in the dark about children even being on set that night, rushing to the water to find a young boy's head severed from its body. You can't see the director rushing around in a panic or hear the mournful wails of Renee's mother that people who were there that night still hear to this day. And you can't see what came after, the careers dismantled, the friendship shattered, the people who knew something was wrong and said nothing and have had to live with that ever since. You can't see the questions that followed, questions that would take years to investigate in a 10-month criminal trial to even attempt to answer. Questions about who knew what and when and why no one said stop. This is the story of the Twilight Zone movie deaths of 1982. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hims.
Hey, real talk for a second. ED is way more common than most guys want to admit. Millions of men deal with it at some point, and a lot of them wait way longer than they should to do anything about it.
And I get it. It's not exactly the easiest thing to bring up. But here's the thing. Through Hims, you don't have to sit in a waiting room or have an awkward conversation at the pharmacy. It's completely online.
You just complete a simple intake, a licensed provider reviews your information, and if treatment is right for you, it ships directly to your door in discreet packaging. That includes Sildenafil, the generic for Viagra, available through Hims at up to 95% less than the brand name.
And if that's not the right fit, there are other treatment options too. It's straightforward, transparent, and it's designed to make getting care feel easy.
To get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/COTC. That's hims.com/COTC for your free online visit. hims.com/COTC.
Prescription required. See website for details and important safety information. Sildenafil is the generic version of Viagra. Viagra is a registered trademark of Viatris Specialty LLC. Hims is not affiliated with or endorsed by Viatris. If you've ever heard even peripherally about this case, it'll come as no surprise to you that it's a complicated one. Enough so that this case will be covered in two episodes, with part one focusing on how these three victims ended up in the path of an out-of-control helicopter, and part two detailing the investigation that led to a nearly year-long trial that forever affected the movie-making industry. Before you can fully understand what happened in the early morning hours of July 23, 1982, you first need to be transported back to the so-called Summer of Spielberg. That's not my designation. That's what Time and Newsweek called the 82 season, thanks to two blockbuster movies produced by Steven Spielberg the month before this accident, released by separate studios 1 week apart. Poltergeist, which came out June 4th, and E.T., which followed on June 11th.
MGM has Poltergeist for release on June 4th. This Steven Spielberg production is about a suburban family terrorized in their spooky new house. With its flashy special effects and ghosts-can-do-anything attitude, Poltergeist is anxiously awaited by those who like to have the heck scared out of them.
They're here.
Also from the mind of Steven Spielberg is E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Little is known about this film except that it stars a friendly alien lost and alone 100,000 light years from home. He's befriended by a small Earth boy. An extension of Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T. is heavy in visual effects. It's set for release on June 4th.
Even before those two movies were released, Spielberg had been having a hell of a run. He had directed Jaws in 1975, then Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 1977. Raiders of the Lost Ark came in 81. The only not-so-acclaimed film he was involved with in that era was a John Belushi vehicle called 1941. Maybe a big-budget war comedy wasn't the best idea. Still, Spielberg was white hot, so when he had the idea for a film version of the 1950s show The Twilight Zone, an idea that would be segmented into four stories, each with their own cast and director, everyone in Hollywood wanted to either direct or star in one of those segments. The directors were chosen early on. Spielberg would get a segment, as would John Landis, who was hot off a few hits of his own. Think Animal House and An American Werewolf in London. Joe Dante, who had previously directed two of my childhood favorites, Piranha and The Howling, would do the third segment. George Miller of Mad Max fame would do the fourth. Miller and Dante would simply be directors of their segments. They weren't overall producers of the movie. Landis was another story. He and Spielberg hammered out a deal that not only made Landis one of the producers, but it gave him wide latitude on his segment. While the other three segments would be remakes of classic Twilight Zone episodes, Landis would write something fresh for his segment. He'd also be given final edit so long as he stayed within a relatively tight $1 million budget for his approximately 30-minute hunk of the film. His idea was both straightforward and kind of trippy all at once. He wrote a segment called Time Out, about a gruff, vulgar, sexist bigot who gets a taste of his own medicine. This character, called Bill Connor, starts off basically insulting everyone who isn't a white male. In the original script, he uses the N-word for black people, the K-word for Jewish people, etc. I mean, he is not a nice guy. Which makes it kind of poetic that he somehow slips through a crack in the space-time continuum to land in Nazi Germany, where he realizes the SS perceives him as a Jewish man and chases him down, and also in the Jim Crow South, where he's perceived as black and is again pursued by people wanting to kill him. He also transports to the Vietnam War, where he spots a helicopter overhead and waves it down, trying to get help, only to realize that the American pilots also see him as the enemy they're fighting. They begin to shoot. Now, I'll mention here that there were no children in the early drafts of the segment, but we'll talk more about that later. The details within the script shift as the segment is refined over time, but the overall gist remains the same. And for Landis, it all hinged on the performance of whoever he found to play Bill Connor. Enter Vic Morrow. Unless you're a film buff, you might not know his work, even if you know his name. His biggest claim to fame was a 1960s TV show called Combat, where he played the battle-hardened Sergeant Chip Saunders.
I'm gonna see to it they throw the book at you.
For what? I was just telling the truth. You ask him, he'll tell you.
I don't have to ask anybody. It's none of my business. And it's none of your business. You got it? So just shut up! Only one thing is your business. One thing, and that's all. That's being a soldier and doing your job, and that is the one thing you didn't do.
Now, here's a sad aside. There are three major books written about Vic Morrow's death, but I couldn't find a single one written about his life. That's part of the reason I didn't want to rush this case and make it a single episode. I want to give the victims here as much due as I can, and that means not just reading off Morrow's IMDb page. I dug through genealogical records and read a bunch of interviews with him, and also with his family members, both before and after his death. I'm piecing together his biography from all of those sources. He was born Victor Morozov, either with an S or a Z, depending on which source you believe, on Valentine's Day of 1929 in the Bronx. His mother, born Eugenia Barmashenko in Russia, became Jeanette when she moved to the United States in 1913. She married Harry Morozov in 1921, according to her petition for naturalization. Victor's parents adopted the surname Morrow after he was born, but before he got famous under the name. Dad Harry, by the way, surely had a different name when he was born, but I couldn't find it. I just know that he was at least nicknamed Grisha, and I know from a 1930 census that he spoke Yiddish and worked as a house painter. He and Jean were probably poor. They had a boarder living with them and their two young children at that point, Vic and his older brother, George Leon, born in 1924. Their neighbors were all immigrants, too. There aren't many accounts of Vic's early life, and what I found through interviews during the peak of his celebrity isn't always reliable. For example, it seems he aged himself down for a while, telling reporters he had been born in 1932 when he was actually 3 years older than that, according to both of his marriage certificates. The main book I even read about this case gives him the wrong age. He didn't talk about his parents or his upbringing in interviews, which 30 years in the storytelling business tells me something. But Vic did talk about having a tough go of things in high school. He told reporter Ruth Thompson in 1966 that he'd been kicked out of a couple of them. So he quit, dropping out of Roosevelt High School at age 17 to run away from his home in the Bronx and join the Navy in 1947. After he got out, he got his diploma by attending night school, then went to South Florida College as a pre-law student. Not long after he had enrolled, though, he got bit by the acting bug. He was cast in the school's production of I Remember Mama, a transformative experience that convinced him to change his major. He didn't graduate from Florida, though, transferring to Mexico City College and bouncing around some odd jobs before being accepted at the famed Actors Studio, which he put himself through while working nights as a taxi driver. It was through the instructor there, Paul Mann, that he met his wife-to-be, Barbara Turner, an actress and writer. The two were frequent collaborators who married in 1957. I found old news briefs about them working together on musicals and such, littering the entertainment sections of newspapers Yore. Morrow was never treated like a leading man, but he was a solid character actor, usually playing tough guys like Saunders. His career had started with 1955's Blackboard Jungle, a movie about a teacher trying to reach unruly inner-city school kids, or as one promo calls them, teenage savages. Morrow and Sidney Poitier are among the young actors who played high school students. After his debut, he worked steadily through the late 50s and early to mid-60s, though the only title I personally recognized was Cimarron, which, like Blackboard Jungle, starred Glenn Ford. There were guest appearances on TV shows like Bonanza, The Rifleman, The Tall Man, and The Untouchables. Then came Combat, which provided him steady work until 1967, when the show was canceled. Along the way, he and Barbara, whose birth name was Gloria, according to their marriage certificate, had two children, Carrie Ann in 1958 and Jennifer Lee in 1962, right at the launch of Combat, which changed the whole family's life. With Combat, Morrow not only got fame and money, but he got to try his hand at directing episodes, which he told reporters was his real passion. He sometimes directed stage productions in New York, he said. For Hollywood, he co-wrote and directed a movie called Death Watch during Combat's run. He had performed in the play version previously and said he planned to keep directing after Combat ended. But that didn't end up paying the bills. He co-directed the James Garner movie, The Man Called Sledge, which Garner later called one of his least favorite films. Meanwhile, Morrow's relationship with his wife was struggling. With the benefit of hindsight, you can see hints of that in some of the stories written at the peak of his career. Take this quote I found in a UPI story by Vernon Scott written in 1963. Quote, "When I'm working in the series, I'm off to the studio at 5:30 in the morning, and I'm so tired after a day's work of climbing hills and firing weapons that I stop for a drink somewhere on the way home. By the time I eat dinner, it's 8 o'clock and I don't get to see much of the children." End quote. It feels like a breadcrumb. Do you need to stop for a drink on the way home when your wife's there with two young children? I mean, Jennifer Lee was only a year old at that point. A year later, Barbara and Vic Morrow divorced. Jennifer wasn't 3 years old yet. Carrie, who was very much a daddy's girl, was 7. Whatever happened in the family afterward has been largely kept quiet. What we do know is that Jennifer dropped her father's surname, changed her middle name to her last name with an altered spelling, and added Jason, in honor of family friend Jason Robards, to become Jennifer Jason Lee. And she did not get along with her father. In 2018, she talked to The Guardian about her childhood and about how she witnessed addiction in the home and about how she didn't want to talk about her father because some people adored his work and she didn't want to ruin that for them. I could be wrong about this, but I suspect this is all interconnected. And I only delve into it to make this point. I think he led a difficult life. By the time his path crossed with John Landis, he had already been married and divorced again, this time to a much younger former flight attendant named Gail Lester. After a good-slash-gross part as a slave catcher in the miniseries Roots, his career had largely been reduced to some TV appearances and B-grade movies. In fact, in 1981, the year before he was cast in Twilight Zone, he starred in The Last Shark, aka The Great White, which I happen to have seen while writing this episode. It is practically a beat-for-beat ripoff of Jaws. It's about a harbor town with a shark problem and a mayor who refuses to cancel a windsurfing regatta despite bite-riddled bodies turning up on the beach. Morrow does his best with the material, serving as the script's stand-in for Robert Shaw.
The answer is no. This is my boat, those are my orders.
No, damn it! It's my shark, Ron. Has to be.
The hell it is! That's just your shark, or your daughter's leg. There are bodies out there, and more to come if we don't end this thing. Jesus, Peter. Don't you think I know the pain you're going through?
But he's down there. He's down there now. He's waiting to attack.
It's been his pattern just before he makes an attack. And this is the only thing we have to stop him. And there's only one dynamite belt. So what's the sense in risking both our necks?
When I say I saw that movie, I should clarify. I saw it via Riff Tracks, the comedy show that makes fun of bad movies. So yeah, this probably wasn't the kind of work Mauro was super proud of. Imagine then how excited he must have been when he landed a role in a Steven Spielberg production. He was to perform the lead role in the opening segment to be directed by an ambitious, wild-eyed young wunderkind named John Landis. He was 53 years old and excited about this role in a way he hadn't been in years. Landis, just 32 years old, represented a new kind of Hollywood. Daring, edgy, raw. He would do anything to get the perfect shot. He told Mauro that their segment would blow the other three in the film away. It would have heart and danger and redemption. The other guys were just rehashing old Twilight Zone storylines, Landis scoffed. In Time Out, he and Mauro would create something fresh and exciting, explosive even. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Rula. Okay, so summer just started, H is out of school, we've got vacations on the books, and life feels pretty full right now. But even in good seasons, a lot of us are caring more than we let on. I checked out Rula recently, went looking for a therapist, and found someone within minutes. I can't believe how easy it was.
That's the thing. It's not just hard to find someone. It's hard to find someone who actually takes your insurance. Most online therapy platforms don't work with insurance at all, so you're either paying full price out of pocket or locked into an expensive subscription.
Rula does it differently. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, and the average copay for Rula patients is just $15 a session. You use your insurance for your physical health, your mental health deserves the same.
And it's not just affordable. Rula matches you with therapists based on your goals, your background, and your preferences. No wait list, no frustrating back and forth. Appointments are available as soon as tomorrow.
Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit rula.com/COTC to get started. That's rula.com/COTC.
You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget. rula.com/COTC.
John Landis's star was ascending in a way Vic Mauro had always dreamed about. Landis was a powerhouse fueled partly by talent, partly by ego, and partly by a background that had taught him that rules were, at best, suggestions. He was born to Shirley and Marshall Landis in Chicago, their third child and first son. The couple had married in 1943. Their wedding announcement said Marshall was a lieutenant with the Air Force, while Shirley had attended Northwestern University. The 1950 census, which doesn't show that John had arrived yet, suggests the family moved around a good bit. Oldest daughter Jean had been born in California, while Joan was born in Illinois. John came in August of that year, but by year's end, the family had moved to Los Angeles, where they stayed put. According to author Stephen Chain in the book Fly By Night, Landis grew up close with his uncle Ben, technically his great-uncle, who, as a lawyer, got recognition as one of the federal prosecutors who nailed Al Capone on tax evasion. After that Chicago case, Uncle Ben moved to California in the 1940s to become a Hollywood lawyer who occasionally dabbled in production. Eventually, he became a judge. That must have been an odd juxtaposition because in 1952, less than 2 years after Ben Landis's brother moved his family to L.A., Marshall Landis was accused of stealing. He was named in a criminal complaint charging him with grand theft for stealing an unframed Picasso ink drawing from a private gallery in Brentwood. The Associated Press described him as a, quote, well-to-do art collector, end quote, in its Wire story about his arrest. The elder Landis supposedly told police at the time, quote, I can't give any reason for taking the picture. I am financially able to purchase it. I did take it, and I want to get this over with, end quote. The drawing was estimated to be worth $350 at the time, which in straight inflation translation is worth about $4,400 today. But come on, it's Picasso. The artist was still 20 years away from dying. That would be worth a fortune now. It seems that wasn't the only piece he stole either. According to the Los Angeles Times, police found at least two other paintings in his Cashmere Terrace home. Friends appeared in court on his behalf, saying he was a quote-unquote very sick boy who needed help. He was a 30-year-old father of three, but okay. It doesn't appear that Marshall Landis served any time for the thefts. He did turn out to be sick, though, in a different way. After surgery for stomach ulcers, he suffered a fatal hemorrhage in 1956 when his son John was only 6 years old. He was only 35 when he died. His obituary noted that he had designed the interiors of the University Synagogue in Brentwood, the Royal Nevada Hotel in Las Vegas, and, quote, many Brentwood and Beverly Hills homes, end quote. Shirley remarried 2 years later to Walter Levine in the Temple Israel in Dayton, Ohio. He worked in construction and, according to their wedding announcement, moved into the home on Cashmere Terrace she had once shared with her first husband. Landis would later say that it was around this time, when he was 8, that he fell in love with movies. He credited one film in particular, 1958's The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, a fantasy adventure film starring Kerwin Matthews. He said he watched the movie twice in the theater and felt totally transported to the world the filmmaker had created. When he got home, he asked his mom about how movies were made. That's when he decided he wanted to become a director, according to Robert K. Elder, who interviewed Landis for the book, The Film That Changed My Life. Like Vic Morrow, he dropped out of high school, though Landis had a more supportive and financially well-off family to fall back on. He got a job in studio mailrooms before whipping out a script for a silly DIY monster movie called Schlock. He played an ape with the help of makeup artist Rick Baker, whose work you surely know from Landis's later movie, An American Werewolf in London, which won Baker an Oscar. Even though Schlock was a goofy send-up of the monster genre, it earned 23-year-old Landis some praise and attention, even landing him on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. It took 4 years for him to get his next gig, but when he did, it was a doozy. Career-wise, anyway. The flick was called The Kentucky Fried Movie, a mishmash of nearly two dozen comedy skits filmed on a shoestring budget. It was just slapstick parody.
I'm not wearing any pants. Film at 11.
Gene Siskel didn't like it. He called it a series of one-joke gags, but audiences did. It made good money, and it led to Landis getting his next gig, the massive hit National Lampoon's Animal House.
What's going on?
They confiscated everything, even the stuff we didn't steal.
They took the bar! The whole fucking bar!
And that led him to the Blues Brothers, which gave us this line, which I still say when going on road trips, even though I don't smoke and I'm rarely headed to Chicago.
It's 106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes, it's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
By the way, this is kind of amazing in hindsight, but Blues Brothers wasn't actually a hit when it was released. It made its money back and then some, but it was considered a disappointment at the time because it hadn't been an obscene moneymaker like Animal House had been. I mean, seriously, Animal House was crazy. A $3 million movie that made something like $141 million in return. Anyway, those movies, and American Werewolf after them, earned Landis a reputation as a guy who was in your face, cutting edge. He could mix humor with pathos and, as Werewolf showed, even horror. That's not an easy combo. He was pretty cocky too, and considered himself a Spielberg-caliber director who wasn't getting Spielberg-style attention. The two knew each other and had met about a couple of projects. In fact, Spielberg even had a cameo as a clerk in Blues Brothers. They were more or less contemporaries, though Landis was a few years younger. Spielberg was born in 1946. They had both been self-starters, too. Spielberg's first noteworthy creation was a 1968 short film called Amblin, which he later used to name his production company Amblin Entertainment. After that short drew some buzz, Spielberg landed directing gigs on a number of TV shows like Marcus Welby MD and Columbo. Then he directed the TV movie that would shift his gear into hyperdrive, Duel. If you've never seen it, you should check it out. It is intense. After that came Sugarland Express and then, of course, Jaws.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
Anyway, come 1981, as Spielberg had Poltergeist and E.T. in the works, he and Landis met to talk about this idea Spielberg had for a four-part Twilight Zone movie adaptation. By keeping it segmented, it would be a nod to the episodic style of the TV show. Spielberg cohort, Frank Marshall of Amblin Entertainment, would serve as head honcho executive producer, while Spielberg and Landis would be regular producers. Then there were a bunch of other associate producers, usually tied to a segment rather than the whole film. You've seen how crazy those production credits can get. But the important part to understand is that Landis was essentially in a number two spot because really Frank Marshall and Spielberg were basically on the same team. Now, to keep creative control of his segment, Landis agreed he would have to keep it on budget. This apparently had to do with crazy overages he had raked up on Blues Brothers, where he kept making the stunts bigger and bigger. At one point in that movie, a helicopter picks up the brothers' so-called Bluesmobile and drops it like 1,000 feet. It's crazy. Twilight Zone was greenlit with a budget of $5 million, $1 million of which was allotted for Landis's segment. Landis could keep that final cut on his segment if and only if he delivered the film within 6 weeks of principal photography ending and kept costs within the production budget. He could only go over by a contingency pot of 10%, meaning if he went past $1.1 million, he would lose final cut. And he wanted to prove he was an auteur, so he didn't want that to happen. Now, there's no doubt a film savant out there is wanting to point out that Landis did more on Twilight Zone than just his segment, and yes, I know he also wrote the prologue and got his buddy Dan Aykroyd to perform it, but here we're talking about the timeout segment. As you can probably sense, there were some complicated feelings flowing between Landis and Spielberg, or maybe it was just flowing from Landis to Spielberg. Regardless, they were peers, and they clearly respected each other. They liked each other well enough to work together. But Spielberg was on top of the world. I'd say he was king of it, but that came later. And Landis thought he deserved the same kind of status. Egos can be a hell of a thing. The bottom line, though, is there was a lot of pressure on the timeout segment to be grand, spectacular, jaw-dropping stuff. Landis reportedly, according to the book Fly By Night, wanted to out Spielberg Spielberg with his segment. He got his general concept down, that a bigot would find himself targeted by the same discrimination he spewed, and he nailed down the actor to bring it to life. Now, he just needed to polish the script. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef. Okay, Scott, I have to be honest, summer with H Home has completely wrecked any illusion I had of being an organized adult. 6 o'clock hits and I'm just staring into the refrigerator like it's going to give me answers.
That's where Home Chef has genuinely saved us. Fresh ingredients show up, the recipes are simple to follow, and the meals actually taste great. No long grocery list, no complicated prep.
And cleanup is minimal, which is huge. Whether you need a 30-minute meal, an oven-ready tray, or even a quick microwave lunch, Home Chef has you covered. Over 30 options a week with choices for all different tastes and dietary needs.
Home Chef is rated number one by users of other meal kits for quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease. And customers save an average average of $86 a month on groceries.
For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 50% off and free shipping on your first box, plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC.
That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life.
Homechef.com/COTC.
Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert.
The first version of John Landis' segment in Twilight Zone the movie wasn't quite what you see in the finished version. The main character, Bill Connor, was even less pleasant than Vic Morrow's portrayal because Landis had him spewing all kinds of uncomfortable epithets. He even called a cocktail waitress a sperm bank. Others involved in the production read the early draft and said, "Geez, man, we have to make this guy somewhat redeemable." So Landis toned him down a hair without losing his overall despicable nature, because that is the point of the character. He has to be awful, but maybe not quite so much of a caricature. Lucy Fisher of Warner Brothers' creative division read an updated version and still felt like audiences would just hate Bill. He was offensive, drunken, and coarse. Plus, the ending wasn't a great payoff. And to understand this, you've got to know the overall gist of the script, which Paul Brody of Well I Never sums up nicely.
Morrow brought Bill Connor's character to life, portraying a bitter middle-aged man fuming at being passed over for a promotion in favor of a Jewish co-worker. Connor downs his troubles at a local bar, uttering slurs towards Jewish, Black, and Asian people. When Connor leaves the bar, he finds himself in Nazi-occupied France, where he is harassed and shot at by SS officers. Next, he finds himself in the rural US South during the 1950s, where a group of Ku Klux Klansmen have mistaken him for an African-American man and are about to lynch him. He jumps into a lake and resurfaces in a jungle in the Vietnam War.
The original script called for Bill, who had already been chased by the SS and KKK, to be run down by a helicopter, which, by the way, was to be heard, not seen, which he would flee by running through a swamp, which would take him back to running from the Klan. And then he would escape into a wooden shed where the Klansmen would start chopping down the door, which would give way to Nazi soldiers grabbing Bill and tossing him into a freight car of a train that's pulling away, and Bill's reaching his arm out between the slats of the car, screaming, "Help me." Then it just ends. So Fisher gave Landis feedback. You need something to redeem this man by story's end, and also the ending has to be more impressive than this. Landis set about rewriting it again. Everyone felt he finally got it right on his fourth attempt. To soften his character, Bill would spot a couple of Vietnamese children in harm's way in the village, a boy and a girl, and the girl would have in her hands a broken and naked Barbie doll, a symbol of her marred youth. Bill would see the universal humanity in that, and he would grab the children and carry them to safety beneath his arms as he was chased down by an on-screen helicopter, not off-screen this time, which would hover overhead and shoot at him as he trudged with the children through a swamp. Fisher reportedly loved this. Years later, we're talking years and years, long after any trial would be held, a packet of info compiled by Warner would see the light of day, and it would reveal that Lucy Fisher felt the children supplied that bit of heart the script had been missing. It seemed perfect. And, in hindsight, so logical. One of those ideas that you kick yourself for not thinking up earlier. After all, E.T. and Poltergeist just featured children in prominent roles. It just made sense. So in this new script, Bill would successfully save the kids, but it wouldn't quite be a happy ending because this is Twilight Zone, right? Bill would be inexplicably transported back to the street scene outside of the bar where the segment had started, with him badmouthing everyone who wasn't just like him. Maybe he's come back a changed man, but the audience doesn't really get to know because he's soon clipped by a car and thrown violently to the curb. A Black bar patron runs up to check him. "Are you okay, man? Can I help?" The script reads, Bill looks at his friend Ray and at the Black patron in wonder. He then looks down at the broken Barbie doll in his hand. It could work. With the right director at the helm, that could be a Twilight Zone appropriate mind F of an ending that delivers a lesson with heart. Fisher loved it, but she did have one question. The film was shooting in California, where it doesn't get dark until at least 9 p.m., and Landis intended to shoot night for night, not day for night. Labor laws didn't let children under 12 years old work past 7. Landis said not to worry, he'd figure it out. Shooting began the second week of July 1982. It was scheduled to last 12 days, with the climactic village scene set to shoot the final day. Morrow, fresh off that Jaws ripoff, was no doubt excited to be back at work and grateful for not just the job, but the chance to potentially revive his flagging career. I mean, I can't emphasize this enough. It's a Spielberg movie filming a month after E.T. and Poltergeist. This had to have seemed like winning the jackpot. But Morrow was also 53 years old and not in the best shape. The shooting schedule was hard on him, and Landis wanted realism, so he wanted Morrow to do his own stunts. Had Morrow been a bigger name, he maybe could have pushed back, but he wasn't. And that's, in fact, one of the reasons Landis wanted him. He wanted a solid actor with the gruff persona Bill needed, who was also, frankly, cheap to hire and hungry for work. Morrow told people close to him that he was doing stuff he had never been asked to do before, and there were some dangerous moments. Early in filming, he hurt his leg during one of the stunts and walked with a limp for a bit. He also had a skin condition that was aggravated by the wetsuit he wore for a part of the Vietnam section, where he found himself in snake-infested waters. In a chase scene, the character Bill had to climb out of a window and run along a ledge to the next building where he fell from the roof. Chain wrote in his book, quote, "For the close-up part of the scene, Vic Morrow ran along the ledge, prodded by the director's barking below. Faster, faster," Landis shouted. Vic did his best. Though the ledge was only 8 feet above the ground, it was high enough to hurt the aging actor if he fell onto the hard cobblestones below. End quote. A makeup artist reportedly was looking on and warned Landis, "Be careful, he might hurt himself." Landis replied, "Stay in your own department." That makeup artist, by the way, was Bob Westmoreland, who was the same guy who noticed an electrical fire had broken out in another scene where 30 people played Jewish prisoners trapped inside of a rail car. He rushed to Landis, who was chatting with assistants, and said, "Hey, there's a real lock on that rail car and real people trapped inside, and there's a fire creeping toward them. Maybe we should do something about it." That crisis was averted. All of these issues and stunts were small potatoes compared to what everyone was to face on the last day of filming. Landis's vision had now evolved from a helicopter firing bullets at Bill Connor and the two fleeing children to them being surrounded by exploding huts along the water's edge. This was to surpass all of the other stunts he had pulled off in his other movies. It would make Blues Brothers look like child's play. The cliche, not the movie. Bill would dart through the water, a hero, saving those beautiful Vietnamese babies and providing the segment, the character arc, everyone wanted. First, of course, they had to hire the children. Now, you would think that by 1982, Hollywood had a pretty solid handle on how to legally employ children on a film set. And technically, it did, on paper. There had been nearly a century of filmmaking at that point, and children have been featured on celluloid from the very beginning. And hey, kids are easy to exploit. So, maybe it's no surprise that the film industry's relationship with child labor law has always been a bit rocky. The early studio system was built on locking young talent into long-term exclusive contracts, but kids had a legal escape hatch. Under the so-called Infancy Doctrine of 1872, they could walk away from any contract without consequence. California closed that loophole in 1927, letting studios get contracts court-approved and binding. Then came the money problems. In 1938, Jackie Coogan, Charlie Chaplin's co-star in The Kid and later Uncle Fester on The Addams Family, sued his mother and stepfather after discovering they had spent nearly his entire $3 to $4 million fortune on fur coats, diamonds, and expensive cars. He had turned 21 3 years earlier, expecting to claim his earnings, and found almost nothing left. The resulting Coogan Act was supposed to protect child actors' earnings, but it was riddled with loopholes and stayed largely toothless until it was overhauled in 2000. Which is all to say, Hollywood had a long and storied history of failing the children it profited from. But money, at least, doesn't kill you. The rules around physical safety on set were a different matter entirely. And in California in 1982, those rules were real and specific. Children couldn't work past a certain hour, and for kids under 12, that cutoff came in the early evening. They couldn't work in proximity to explosions. They required permits for themselves and for their employer, issued by the State Labor Board. And if you wanted an exception to any of that, you could apply for a waiver, but you had to ask. John Landis was told all of this. His own casting agency flagged it. The children he needed for this scene, to carry through the river, fleeing the helicopter, making his racist protagonist into a hero at the last minute, were 6 and 7 years old. There was no version of the shoot at 2 a.m. surrounded by pyrotechnics that was going to get approved. And Landis knew it. He asked through a few back channels so he would stay under the radar, but every time he did, he was told in no uncertain terms, no one would approve this. It's crazy. So he never applied for a waiver. As John Landis eventually testified, quote, "We decided to break the law," end quote. Instead of going through a casting company, associate producer George Folsey Jr. found the children through personal connections. One was found through Folsey's production coordinator's husband, who worked for an Asian mental health center. The hired children's parents, one set of whom didn't speak English, were not told the scene would involve running beneath a low-hovering helicopter with explosives detonating all around them. In fact, they were assured the explosives were on par with firecrackers. The kids were paid $500 a day in cash under the table. Their names were kept off the call sheets. And when a fire safety officer showed up on set who also happened to be a child welfare worker, Landis and Folsey kept the children hidden from him because they knew he would have immediately known they were there illegally because no one would have given a permit for kids to work at 2:30 in the morning, in the dark, under a helicopter, with bombs exploding next to them. At some point during all the madness, Landis reportedly joked, "We're all going to jail." It got some nervous chuckles from the people on set who weren't comfortable with the plan. Of course, it turned out that jail wasn't what Landis should have been worried about. In his quest to capture an amazing shot with Vic Morrow running through a fake Vietnamese jungle river, two kids in his arms as a helicopter chased him down and straw huts exploded around him, Landis refused suggestions that stunt doubles be used for Morrow or lifeless dummies be used for the kids. The audience would know, he reportedly insisted. It had to be real. We know what happened next, as Dan Rather reported later that day.
The scene for a movie version of Twilight Zone attempted to recreate the terror and the carnage of the hell that was Vietnam. And then, as the crew watched in horror early this morning, the make-believe dissolved and actor Vic Morrow and two Vietnamese children were killed.
Headlines called it a bizarre accident, and surely it was. No one set out that night to kill three people. But questions soon arose about producers' quick claims that this accident was unavoidable. Investigators descended on the scene. They interviewed witnesses and took measurements and watched the fatal footage shot from multiple camera angles. There was no question that two children shouldn't have died that night, And they weren't even supposed to be there after all. But would this freak accident have occurred if, say, professional stunt people had been used? If a more experienced pilot had helmed the chopper? If a different director had helmed the film? It wasn't long before county prosecutors decided the answer to those questions was a resounding no. For the first time ever, a Hollywood director was indicted, alongside others, on manslaughter charges for deaths that occurred on his set. But it would take nearly 4 years before the case went to trial and another 10 months before a jury reached their decision. And it would be years after that before the full truth would finally come out. That's what we'll unpack in next week's episode. To research this case, I read Fly By Night, The Secret Story of Steven Spielberg, Warner Brothers, and the Twilight Zone Deaths by Stephen Chane, who does not like commas or brevity, but really likes exclamation points, sometimes three in a row. I spent a long time in genealogical records, providing you the fullest biography to date about Vic Morrow. I also read a lot of news coverage, both contemporary and retrospective, and read portions of the out-of-print book Outrageous Conduct by Stephen Farber and Mark Green. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod. And you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.